ISIS claims responsibility for a deadly bombing attack in Iran. And in Ukraine, prisoners of war are now back home, freed and in exchange with Russia.
They were hugging each other, wearing Ukrainian flags. But on the other hand, I could see the pain in their eyes.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. American roads are much more dangerous than those in other developed countries, and not just for pedestrians.
Pretty much every wealthy country, you'd much rather be not just a pedestrian or a cyclist, but inside a car in those countries than in the U.S.
Then the industry is still recovering, but some types of international travel are back big time.
A lot of people called the pandemic the end of the cruise economy, and that entirely false.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. 22 months since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, it's hard to see how this war ends, especially when there are no active peace negotiations happening. But there were successful talks culminating in what's being described as the biggest prisoner exchange yet in this conflict. On Wednesday, nearly 500 prisoners of war, more than 200 each from both Russia and Ukraine, got to go home. In a video statement posted last night, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky thanked his team of negotiators for helping to make it happen. Despite everything, Zelensky said, this is long-awaited good news. For more, we're joined by The World's Daniel Offman in Riga, Latvia. Daniel, this exchange happened even as there was intense fighting between the two countries. It was the first prisoner swap in 5 months. What was involved here?
Well, this deal came as a surprise to everyone until, of course, it was announced yesterday. So the negotiations happened secretly, behind the scenes, with no leaks. But the result of this deal is really significant. So Ukraine released 248 Russian prisoners in exchange for 230 Ukrainians. In a statement yesterday, Kirill Budanov, that's Ukraine's military intelligence chief, he confirmed that the United Arab Emirates helped mediate the negotiations. He also said that some of the Ukrainian prisoners were captured in Mariupol. That was in the early months of the war. So that means that some of these soldiers have been prisoners for almost 2 years. And it's also really worth mentioning that this deal happened despite the fact that Russia has recently intensified attacks on Ukraine, drone attacks and missile attacks. So negotiations are still happening. They're ongoing, even with intense fighting.
So what was the scene like as Ukrainian prisoners arrived back home, as you said, after up to almost 2 years?
So when the swap happened, photos and some videos quickly started appearing online, and there was one moment that stood out to me. So in this video, a freed Ukrainian prisoner says, "We're home, you didn't forget us." There was also footage of freed prisoners singing the Ukrainian anthem. And again, some of these soldiers, as we mentioned, have been in Russian captivity for more than a year. Here's Maria Avdieva, a Ukraine-based security analyst.
You can see how happy they were to speak Ukrainian. They were saying Slava Ukraini, and they were hugging each other, wearing Ukrainian flags. But on the other hand, I could see the pain in their eyes.
Avdieva said that many of the prisoners looked malnourished, and overall, Russia's treatment of Ukrainian prisoners has been really poor. There have even been documented cases of torture. Now, on the other side, we've also seen Russia's defense ministry put out a video of Russian prisoners returning home. So in Russia, this will also be presented as a big diplomatic success story.
Daniel, there have been other prisoner exchanges before. How does this one compare?
Well, first of all, there hasn't been a prisoner swap between Russia and Ukraine since August. But before that, there were a bunch. And as we mentioned, this one is the biggest so far. But to put it in perspective, Ukraine's Commissioner for Human Rights, Dmytro Lubinets, said that there have been 49 exchanges total so far. And as a result of all of these swaps, about 3,000 Ukrainians have been freed. Now, there's been a lull since the summer, but overall, this negotiation channel between Russia and Ukraine has functioned. It's worked. Usually there's a third party playing a mediating role, like in this case, the UAE. And bringing home POWs is seen as a top priority. Volodymyr Zelensky spoke about this yesterday.
І будемо і надалі працювати, аби повернути наших, усіх наших.
He's saying here, we will continue this work to return our people, all of our people. And already since yesterday, other Ukrainian officials have signaled that more prisoner swaps could follow soon.
The World's Daniel Offman bringing us news of a major prisoner exchange between Ukraine and Russia. He joins us from Riga, Latvia. Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Carolyn.
We have an update now on a story that we reported on yesterday. Two explosions in the Iranian city of Kerman on Wednesday killed 84 people and injured many more, according to Iranian officials. Today, ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack. In a statement posted on the group's Telegram channel, it said two of its members detonated explosive belts strapped to their bodies. Seamus Malik Afsadi, who writes about the Middle East, says this attack by ISIS came as a surprise.
The reason why I think this attack was so unexpected was that recent attacks have primarily targeted Shia shrines within the country, and attacks of such a political nature, by which I mean targeting the image of the assassinated IRGC commander Qasem Soleimani, have not happened in years.
Malik Afsadi says Iranian officials quickly pointed the finger at Israel for Wednesday's attack. Still, he says the news that ISIS is now claiming responsibility will not change Iran's rhetoric toward Israel and the U.S.
I don't think this will change drastically the calculus that Iran has made so far in this war, in that it has acted very cautiously and has tried to not escalate things directly with its own military forces.
The attack in Iran took place at a ceremony commemorating the four-year anniversary of the death of one of Iran's top military generals. Qasem Soleimani was killed in a U.S. drone strike in Baghdad. In an interview with The World yesterday, Iran expert Sina Tusi told us how Soleimani is viewed in Iran, and he raised the possibility of ISIS involvement.
In Iran, he's largely seen as someone who helped defeat ISIS and kind of in Iraq and Syria led a lot of the ground campaign against ISIS, which also contributes to making ISIS as one of the potential suspects in today's bombing in Kerman.
Experts say that insecurity across the region is running high. More U.S. hospitals are bringing back mask requirements. It's flu season, and there's been a rise in COVID cases. The number of coronavirus infections is far lower than they once were. But testing isn't as common as it once was, so it's not easy to know how a spike in cases here in the U.S. compares with the situation in other countries. Michael Minna is an epidemiologist and formerly with the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He's now the chief science officer for eMed Digital Healthcare. Michael, can you talk about the COVID variant that is behind this recent spike in cases here in the U.S.?
The emerging variant, JN1, it's still somewhat of an offshoot of other variants, but it's quite distinct compared to some of the more recent ones. It has not only a significant number of new mutations, but there's even evidence to suggest that its mode of replication and the way that it's utilizing some of the receptors, in particular ACE2, and another molecule called TMPRSS2, is actually a little bit distinct, which might even be making it potentially thrive a little bit better, for example, in the gut rather than in the nose, in the nasopharynx. So it's actually kind of changing its biology a little bit.
Outside the U.S., when you look at a global dashboard, what cities or countries are seeing surges of COVID right now?
Really across most of Europe, across most of really the Northern Hemisphere. And this is a reflection of it being the wintertime in the north. But we're also even seeing some surges and outbreaks in places like South Africa, places that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be seeing such large outbreaks and new outbreaks during their summer. But it's really a reflection of the emergence of new variants like JN1, which are able to kind of break through those seasonal barriers, if you will, because the force of infection, meaning the virus can get out into the population so aggressively in areas where immunity against the virus is not so great because it's a new variant. But we're even seeing them in places that are currently summer.
It's interesting, you know, 4 years into this global phenomenon, what was a global pandemic, that the transmission rates and surges are still different from country to country.
you know, some areas, like there's a very complex dynamic around how recently have different countries or populations or communities been exposed to large outbreaks. And that's going to a certain degree going to impact the impact that new variants have at any given point in time. So for example, if you have one country that went through a major surge in cases and say 60% of the population had an infection or got exposed in the last 4 months, then that might be an area that today might not be quite as susceptible even to a new variant. There is such heterogeneity across the globe that really identifying exactly where those hotspots will be at any given point in time has become quite challenging because of the continued emergence of new variants and the interplay between immunity and seasonality across the globe.
If there were a mutation in COVID that made it more lethal again, how are global health authorities positioned right now to be able to tackle that? Are we in better shape than we were globally four and a half years ago?
Well, on the one hand, we're certainly in better shape because we have therapeutics and we have vaccines. And all of those, like especially vaccines and previously acquired immunity, will provide us protection from a huge assortment of new variants. But if we hold everything else constant, we say, okay, a new variant comes on board today that is very lethal, and let's say our drugs that we have available stop working for it. My personal opinion is that we're actually at a worse position in time than we perhaps were 4 years ago. The good thing is we know how to build new vaccines. The bad thing is there's been a massive erosion of public trust in our public health agencies. There's exhaustion at the community and population level to even consider thinking about this virus anymore. And there's been a huge lack of interest politically to fund any new public health initiatives that have anything to do with COVID. And so I think it would be a really hard problem to deal with if a new variant that was very, very aggressive really came on board today. And whether that's COVID or potentially a new virus, if somebody were to declare a new pandemic, I actually am very, very concerned that we are in a more difficult spot societally.
That is disheartening to hear.
I agree. I think that it's going to be one of the big challenges of the next decade, in my view, if not more, to really kind of get society back on course in a way that, you know, where we can see a virus like COVID as a common enemy across all people.
Michael Minna is an epidemiologist and chief science officer for eMed Digital Healthcare. Michael, thanks for joining us again.
Well, thank you for having me.
The world of competitive darts has been on fire this week. As we told you yesterday, the World Darts Championship had a final matchup last night between two Lukes: the world number one player, 28-year-old Luke Humphreys, and Luke Littler, the 16-year-old superstar who seemed to come out of nowhere.
There is no sign of this teenage dream coming to an end. Luke Littler sweeps aside.
And if Luke Littler wins tonight, then probably one of the greatest sports stories, in my opinion, we'll ever see.
That last voice there was Luke Humphreys talking about the 16-year-old phenom before the match. Alas, for Luke Littler, the teenage dream did come to an end last night. He lost to the top-seeded Humphreys 7-4. The 2 hours of darts played out in front of a huge crowd at the Alexandra Palace in London, with more people watching online. Humphreys took home $630,000 as the winner. But 16-year-old Littler did not leave empty-handed. He took home $250,000 in prize money and all kinds of accolades from the darts world. Humphreys said afterward that he needed to win now because Luke Littler's darts career is only just beginning. You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. Depending on where you're from, getting a visa to travel to the U.S. can be a real challenge. Slots for visa interviews are particularly tough to get if you're from India. So Indians with relatives here are missing out on important family events. Others are seeing business opportunities slip away or delaying higher education. In other words, these long waits for U.S. visas are more than just an inconvenience, as Sushmita Patak reports from Delhi.
Over the summer, Ankush Pal was thrilled to learn that he had been invited to present a paper at a conference at Southern Illinois University. Pal is a sociology student in Delhi.
As an undergrad, it's a big deal. It's close to once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to even be invited.
The conference was 4 months away, and Pal's trip was fully funded. There was only one problem. The earliest visa appointment was 10 months after the conference.
It doesn't really make sense, right? I have the interview this year in August. What am I going to do there?
So many Indians have similar stories. In 2022, wait times for non-immigrant visas in India skyrocketed to 1,000 days.
Are you planning a trip to the United States? Then get ready to be disappointed because you may end up crossing calendars.
At first, the holdup was due to a backlog from the pandemic when consulates were working at reduced capacity. Staff has now returned to U.S. missions in India, but they're seeing tremendous demand.
1 million Indian travelers have applied for a U.S. visa this year.
That's Eric Garcetti, the U.S. ambassador to India, appearing in a video last year when U.S. missions in India processed more visas than ever before. To speed up the process, they waived interview requirements for some applicants and are expanding operations.
We're going to see not just one, but two new consulates here in India.
Student visas are especially popular. Indians are the largest group of international students in the U.S. Embassies prioritize student visas. But even so, the process is far from simple, says applicant Vikas Bhattacharya. Grabbing a slot requires logging into the visa portal again and again.
Maybe 6-7 times daily, yeah, at different points of time. Sometimes it's at midnight, sometimes it's early in the morning.
Bhattacharya is supposed to start school later this month, but doesn't have a visa yet and risks losing his PhD spot and scholarship. Still, students from India are luckier than visitors, who may have to wait up to 260 days for a US visa. That's almost double the global average. Those who can't afford to wait have one last resort. Visa agents who guarantee an early slot for an extra fee. But it's risky, says Ankush Pal from Delhi.
I'm expected to share the credentials with them in the first place. I'm not sure what happens with my account at that time.
Pal says many of these agents turn out to be scammers. The visa delay is also a diplomatic headache. New Delhi is an important strategic partner for Washington. At a panel discussion last year about U.S.-India ties, experts said solving the visa issue should be a priority. Joseph Felter is with the Hoover Institution.
Let's make it easy to get visas to the U.S., okay? That needs to happen. Let's unleash the soft power of both the U.S. and India. Let's create the conditions to build those people-to-people ties.
Clearing visa hurdles for skilled Indian workers would help the U.S. too, as it ramps up semiconductor production to compete with China. Dhruv Jaishankar is with the Observer Research Foundation America.
Essentially today, the U.S. badly needs workers with basic STEM skills and is not able to produce them in sufficient volume. The only place they're going to be able to get skilled workers at scale, at the scale required, is from India. So some kind of mobility agreement between the U.S. and India would go a long way towards benefiting both countries.
Making people wait for visas hurts the U.S. economy too. Long waits are also common in countries like Brazil and Mexico, where there's a large demand for visas. If delays persist, applicants may look to travel or study elsewhere, like Vikas Bhattacharya, the aspiring PhD student.
I'm scared of going through this whole thing again.
He's now thinking of applying to Germany. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Delhi.
Going for a walk is good for your health, but it can also be deadly. There's been an alarming rise in pedestrian deaths here in the U.S. A recent New York Times investigation discovered a 77% increase in pedestrian fatalities over the last decade or so. In other wealthy countries, the opposite is happening. There's been a decrease in road deaths in general. To understand why, we got in touch with David Zipper. He's a senior fellow with MIT's Mobility Initiative and based in Washington. So, David, I want to start with the year 2009. I understand that's when this increase in pedestrian deaths on American streets seems to have begun. So what is the driving factor here?
Well, there's a lot of things that are happening at the same time. The things that have changed include a number of factors. For one, we are in the U.S. increasingly buying large SUVs and trucks, which put pedestrians at significant risk, both because of blind zones and because the impact on a tall vehicle is likely to hit someone's chest, which can be a lot more dangerous than if it hits their legs. At the same time, too, we have been increasingly distracted, it seems, by our smartphones. That's been something that has become
really a problem almost similar to drunk driving, the idea of distracted driving.
So we've mentioned that the U.S. is something of an outlier here. In many other wealthy countries, deaths are actually going down. How big of a difference is the trajectory here between the U.S. and, let's say, European countries?
Oh, it's night and day. And it's not just Europe, by the way. It's pretty much every wealthy country. You'd much rather be not just a pedestrian or a cyclist, but inside a car in those countries than in the U.S. To give you just a few little statistics, at this point today, the average American is 2.5 times more likely to die in a crash than a Canadian, 3.5 more times more likely to die than an Israeli, 5 times more likely than someone from Japan. I mean, we now are at a 40-year high for both pedestrian and cyclist deaths, and no other country that is an affluent nation is anywhere near that kind of a crisis level.
As a bike commuter, that stat is a little harrowing to hear. So we've talked a bit about what the U.S. is doing wrong. What are these other countries getting right that maybe we could learn from?
Well, it's a lot of things. And it's not like there's a silver bullet, but there's a number of policies that have been adopted overseas that we really have not adopted. For example, other nations, including Canada and including Europe, are much more likely to have pedestrianized central cities, to have slowed down car traffic in the urban core. They're more likely to have automatic speed cameras and automatic traffic cameras that will issue tickets in the mail.
Are there any cities abroad that are doing things that we haven't seen in the U.S. or that are rare here that we could learn from?
Oh, God, yes. Where to start? I mean, I'm particularly interested in Scandinavia, where cities such as Oslo and Helsinki have gone a full year recently without a single pedestrian or cyclist death. It's funny, I was in Helsinki about a year ago, and while I was there, the United States Department of Transportation put out this request for proposals for how technology could make pedestrians safe at intersections. So I was meeting with this Helsinki urban planner at the time, and I asked him, what role has technology, what role has that played in keeping people safe in Helsinki? And he looked at me like I was insane. And he said, it's done nothing at all. Technology plays no role here. We simply slow down the traffic. It's revealing for how Europe approaches street safety, thinking about infrastructure first versus how the U.S. approaches it, which is often involving thinking of technology first.
Fascinating stuff. We've been speaking to David Zipper. He's a senior fellow at MIT's Mobility Initiative. Thank you so much for taking the time, David.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The World. These days, he's a pop star with a big social media following. But growing up in Tripoli, the capital of Libya, as a shy kid, music was really his escape.
I started writing songs when I was like 12 years old as a way to cope with life. I was a bit of an introverted child.
The music and perspective of Bahjat Atourjman ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. North Korea is already one of the most isolated countries on Earth, and it soon could become even more so. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un ended 2023 with a fiery speech about preparing for war. He also said the North is no longer hoping to reunify with the South. This comes on the heels of Kim's government shutting down several of its embassies abroad. Officials in the capital, Pyongyang, have talked about a policy shift. But as The World's Patrick Quinn reports, the real reason probably has to do more with cold, hard cash.
A North Korean embassy is more than just a diplomatic outpost. It's also a place to make money, by criminal means if necessary.
Numerous stories have come out about North Korean diplomats getting caught laundering money, smuggling weapons or luxury goods.
Emma Whitmire studies North Korea for the Asia Society Policy Institute in New York. She says the country abuses diplomatic pouches, special containers shipped abroad by embassies. Customs agents aren't allowed to open them. Diplomats are supposed to use these pouches to send classified files. Whitmire says North Korean officials have used them to smuggle all sorts of things around the world.
Alcohol, tobacco, some other items have included super notes, which are highly sophisticated counterfeit bills, and even rhino horns.
All of these overseas crimes help fund the regime back home. But in the last 10 weeks, North Korea has abruptly shut down embassies across the globe.
Angola, Bangladesh, Hong Kong, Spain, the Congo, Senegal, Nepal, Uganda, and Guinea as well.
Pyongyang officials say this is, quote, part of regular affairs. But a country losing 20% of its embassies in short order isn't regular. It could suggest a crisis. Emma Whitmire says North Korea is in crisis, struggling under severe financial hardships.
Financial hardships due to the impact of international sanctions like those from the United Nations.
UN and U.S. sanctions forbid the country from exporting everything from seafood to coal, effectively strangling the North Korean economy. On top of that, Whitmire says, North Korea's cash reserves are low after closing its borders during the COVID-19 pandemic. This reduced border trade with China to a trickle. And on top of that, there's a food shortage made worse by a bitter winter. So North Korea, she says, is finding ways to cut expenses. She expects more embassies to close in 2024.
I don't know if it'll be another set of 9, but I definitely predict a few more.
But not every North Korea analyst thinks the country's finances are so dire. Mason Ritchie is a professor with Hankuk University in Seoul. He says, think of the embassy closures as part of a corporate restructuring.
The reason why that term is useful is because it underscores the fact that the regime is rational and it hasn't made this decision in a fit of pique, that it hasn't made this decision most likely in a state of panic.
Ritchie says North Korea definitely makes enough money to keep those embassies open. One of its hottest revenue streams is cybercrime, raking in, according to South Korean intelligence, as much as $700 million per year, namely through cryptocurrency scams. The private tech security firm Chainalysis in New York estimates that figure is even higher, $1.7 billion. Either way, Ritchie says cybercrime profits surely eclipse smuggling rackets carried out by North Korean diplomats.
So when you think of corporate restructuring, you think of, you know, pointy-headed nerds who come in and look at the numbers and count the beans and decide, you know, who stays and who gets fired.
He says to a profit-focused regime, some embassies probably look like dead wood, especially when its relationship with a powerful neighbor is blossoming. Russia needs artillery to sustain its war in Ukraine, and North Korea has sold it more than 1,000 containers of shells, according to U.S. intelligence agencies.
North Korea stepped into the breach and has entered into this incredibly beneficial relationship now between Pyongyang and Moscow.
Ritchie says North Korea has every reason to focus diplomacy on Russia and China, its main trading partner. That's where the money is. Pruning less profitable relationships makes good business sense. That said, he does not expect North Korea to shut down many more embassies in 2024. He does expect North Korea to keep sending personnel overseas, ostensibly to do IT work, some of it legit, much of it criminal.
Many of those workers are also moonlighting as hackers as well.
Proceeds from that hacking, according to United Nations reports, is believed to help fund North Korea's nuclear weapons program. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
As the holiday travel season wraps up, Americans who went abroad noticed something different. They didn't have to wait forever to get a passport. That's partly because the bureaucratic logjam from the pandemic started to clear up. Looking ahead at 2024, travel experts say this could be the busiest travel year ever. For more on all of that, Henley Vasquez is the co-founder of the Fora travel agency based in New York. Remind us, Henley, what was causing that logjam for passports last year? And why did it clear up?
So there was a big backlog in terms of the government not having enough people to process the passports and too many people looking for passport renewals. That really has cleared out. There was another surge right before the summer, and we saw wait times that were pretty long. But these days, it's okay. You'll be able to get your passport. You'll be able to pay an expediting fee if you need to. What you won't be able to do yet is renew it online, although we're hoping there may be some updates to that in 2024.
So that's pretty good news for anyone thinking ahead to 2024 travel. There are always trendy travel destinations each year. What are some of the hotspots you're expecting this year?
Yeah, I think a lot of the hotspots that we've seen, so Japan, Europe, these are continuing to be very popular, of course. But then we're seeing a real rise in almost the secondary cities. So going to San Sebastian instead of Barcelona, going to New Orleans instead of New York. So people looking for those sort of secondary cities, not just the capitals. The capitals, I think what we see there is very event oriented. So Olympics in Paris this summer, or Monaco for F1, Taylor Swift, everywhere is driving the travel economy. So event-oriented travel, very popular right now.
Interesting. I gather that cruises are back on the rise again with American travelers after an obvious pandemic slump in the interest in those. What is behind that?
Yeah, it's funny because I think a lot of people called the pandemic the end of the cruise economy, and that was entirely false. They have come back. They have come back better than ever. And I think that's what we're seeing is, look, people want two things. They want very interesting, like experiences-oriented travel like Bhutan or wellness. And then the flip side of that is they want easy things, and cruises are easy.
Are there other ways that travel is looking different now than it did pre-pandemic? So are people seeking like different kinds of trips or experiences when they travel?
I think one of the things that we've seen happen is the prices have gone up so much and they're not stopping. We expect the prices to continue to rise, both in terms of airline costs and hotels, which is why I think a lot of travelers are looking into more sort of the lifestyle hotel genre. And we're even seeing a lot of the sort of more traditional luxury brands launching lifestyle brands to meet travelers where they're at, which is like, I may not be able to afford the most expensive one. I still want a great travel experience. I still want something cool and new.
What's expected to happen with flight prices? I understand they were, you know, really high with the post-pandemic travel rebound. Are they expected to stabilize or come down at all in 2024?
I personally have yet to see that happen. I'd love for it to happen. But I think what we see both as travelers and as travel advisors is it's not happening. There's no game to play where you're going to find a good deal on a flight by waiting for prices to come down. If you know that you're traveling somewhere, the sooner that you secure a price, the sooner you secure a seat, the better. Flights are full. Anybody who's been on a plane or been in an airport recently knows that it's busy. And I don't predict, even if there's a slight softening, I don't think we're suddenly going to move into the era of flights being affordable again.
I'm told there's a new thing called bleisure. Am I saying that right? Combining business with leisure. Can you tell me more about that trend?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That is something that we see happening quite a bit. So someone has to travel during the week somewhere for business. So they're going to Miami for work. Well, then their friends or their partner or their family might be coming in to spend the weekend with them.
What other advice can you give to travelers on how to have the best and smoothest experience for their 2024 travels in what's expected to be a busy travel year?
If we can encourage people to start to plan ahead a little bit more, particularly when we're talking about some of this event-oriented travel or smaller cities where there's just less hotel rooms to be had, we would encourage that. Certainly using a travel advisor makes things a little bit easier because that is your guide to get through the chaos of planning travel.
For U.S. travelers, how popular are domestic destinations versus international ones going to be in the coming year?
What happened this fall is we saw a lot of uncertainty with travelers, feeling nervous about traveling abroad, feeling unsure of the state of the world. And so what we're seeing now is a move back towards more domestic locations, as well as sort of other North American locations, places that are going to be nearby. That's a trend that we saw, and it's not stopping. I really believe that what we've got in our backyard is sort of fantastic. Many of us discovered that during COVID, and I think we're going to be rediscovering that this year.
Henley Vasquez with Fora Travel in New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Child labor is a problem around the world. Globally, about 1 in 10 children work, many of them against their will. In Uzbekistan, once part of the Soviet Union, the authoritarian government recently stopped this practice in the country's cotton industry. But as Levi Bridges reports from Uzbekistan, deep problems remain in that sector of the economy.
In a large field in western Uzbekistan, workers pluck big, fluffy clumps of cotton off tall stalks, rustling the cotton plants as they work. Uzbekistan is one of the world's largest cotton producers. Each year, from the end of summer until as late as December, millions of Uzbeks pick cotton. At lunchtime in this field, workers sit on blankets around metal pots of rice and steaming cups of black tea. Picking cotton pays better than average wages, but it's still honestly not great pay, one woman tells me. Workers here ask not to use their names because they fear retaliation for not speaking positively about the job. Until recently, Uzbekistan's government forced adults and children as young as 9 to pick cotton. Instead of going to school every fall, kids worked in the fields. Gulnos Mamarasulova was first sent away to pick cotton when she was 11.
It was very difficult as a young girl to be far away from the home for a long period. We cried a lot.
Mamarasulova says the kids had it bad, but the university students had it even worse. If they didn't pick enough cotton, they were punished.
During the night, they peeled vegetables and cleaned the restroom.
So your punishment if you don't pick enough cotton is that they don't let you sleep.
Yes, yes. And next day, they joined us to pick cotton.
This system started when Uzbekistan was still part of the Soviet Union, and it continued for decades. Only when companies like Levi's, H&M, and Adidas started to boycott Uzbek cotton did the government gradually work to end forced labor. As part of the reforms, the government handed over control of the cotton industry to private businesses. But new problems cropped up. At a Turkish restaurant in the regional capital, Nukus, I meet with local cotton farmers. One woman tells me they were all forced to sign documents that handed over their farmland to one of the new companies, but she refused. She says a group of men beat up her son to pressure the family. She didn't want to give her name because she's worried they might hurt them again. She took legal action and was able to reclaim her land, but other farmers I talked to weren't so lucky. The Uzbek government has made strides in improving conditions in the cotton industry. They set up a hotline for workers and no longer take kids out of school to harvest. But Umida Niyasova, an Uzbek human rights defender who monitors the harvest, says much work still needs to be done, especially for farmers. She says many are still required by the state to grow cotton.
So farmers, they have no right to choose what crop to produce. And even cotton is not profitable, they still must produce cotton.
I asked the government how they're responding to farmers' complaints, but I didn't receive a response before the story aired. The Uzbek government tightly controls civil society and free speech. Even bloggers are jailed here. But the country needs foreign companies to buy its cotton, and it wouldn't look good to jail people who critique the cotton industry. So there's a bit more tolerance for that sort of dissent right now. At a gallery in the Uzbek capital, Tashkent, I visit an exhibit highlighting the problems with the cotton industry. Like the fact that Uzbekistan produces so much cotton, parts of the country are running out of water. The curator, Timur Karpov, shows me a painting of a giant mushroom cloud made of cotton.
It's a cotton bomb. No. Cotton, it is a disaster. The consequences are the same as after the nuclear blast.
Karpov says labor violations are still happening. And the reforms, which turn the industry over to companies, allow the government to wash their hands of any problems.
Officials will say, well, no, it's all private companies doing that. It's not government anymore. You see? And like, they not taking any responsibility, like none.
Last month, the government shuttered a new organization that worked to improve the conditions of cotton farmers. And this fall, new reports of forced labor of adults in Uzbek cotton fields started surfacing again. It's nowhere near the scale it was previously, and there are no new reports of child labor. Allison Gill is a lawyer working to reform Uzbekistan's cotton industry. She says it's still hard for clothing companies to trust Uzbekistan.
I am concerned that Uzbekistan is kind of squandering an opportunity. Uzbekistan hasn't developed real systems for accountability. And so it's really hard for brands to have the kind of assurances that they need that they're not going to get in trouble.
Gill says many American companies still don't buy Uzbek cotton. That's partially because U.S. lawmakers passed legislation recently that requires the garment industry to not buy cotton produced by forced labor in China. The law and potential consumer backlash are forcing brands to be more careful. On one of the first cold days of winter, workers chop down cotton plants with scythes. The harvest has ended. As of now, Uzbekistan sells most of the cotton here to countries that don't prioritize human rights, like China and Russia. For the world, Levi Bridges, Nukus, Uzbekistan.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We don't hear a lot about musicians from Libya, so let's fix that. One of the country's prominent singer-songwriters is a man named Bahjat Atorjman. The 28-year-old fled the war in Libya and relocated to Europe, where he's promoting his own style of Arabic pop music. The World's Halima Gakandi has his story.
Singer Bahjat already looks the part of a pop star on the rise. He has big, stylish, curly hair, wears a silver Africa pendant around his neck, and has stacks of rings on his fingers. He looks cool and confident, but he tells me that growing up in Libya's capital, Tripoli, he was actually a really shy kid, and music was his safe space.
I started writing songs when I was like 12 years old as a way to cope with life. I was a bit of an introverted child. So music for me was like, okay, this happened, that's cool today. I'm going to go home. I'm going to deal with it by writing a song about it.
Bahjat later started posting songs on YouTube and made up his mind to become a professional singer. But then in 2011, conflict broke out in Libya.
The revolution happened and it turned into a very, unfortunate situation where, you know, there was civil war and there was all of these things that didn't make it an environment where you can flourish in a way.
Bahjat and his family packed up their lives and fled to Malta as refugees. That's where he still lives now. Bahjat tells me things weren't easy. War taught him how things can change in an instant.
And music was the only thing that did not disappear. The way I coped with life continued being the same. So yeah, I started releasing music and just putting my all into it. I did it day and night. I breathed it. I loved it. I still love it. And yeah, I guess somehow people liked it.
More than like, I'd say. One of his songs, Hometown Smile, has millions of views and listens online.
Hometown Smile is a song I wrote about how even during the toughest of times in the experience we went through, my mom always kept a smile on her face, and it kind of taught me that, you know what, you can be going through the worst situations, but looking at the face of someone that you love and seeing that smile, you're like, yeah, I feel home now.
The message has clearly resonated with his fans. They call themselves Bahjat Troops. Bahjat mostly sings in a genre he calls A-pop or Arabic pop and blends Arabic and English in his songs. But he tells me his fan base goes far beyond the Arabic-speaking world, from India to the United States.
And I think that's the beauty of pop music, is that it truly shows you how many people feel the same emotion in different ways. So I guess what I want people to feel is I want them to feel heard and I want them to feel hopeful that things will get better.
In his music, Bahjat says he also wants to be open and frank about those emotions.
Hey, how you been? Just checking in.
He does that in his song Halba, which means very much in Libyan dialect.
So the whole premise of the song is just, you know, thinking about somebody and just letting them know, like, I think I'm in love, but like, I don't want to admit it, but I think about you quite often. Like, you know, I tell my friends about you quite often. And I'm very proud of Halba because it's one of those songs where I think I was able to use a purely Libyan word and use it in a way that's easily sung by anyone.
I tell my friends about you.
Bahjat tells me the Libyan dialect is really suited for pop music because of the small linguistic ways it differs from more popular forms of Arabic.
We also have a lot of like ease in our dialect. For example, if I were to say me or I, in Egyptian, I would say ana. In Libyan, it's ane. So the e or e is very musical, because anything that ends and lands on a very open vowel is, I would say, makes pop music very catchy. So I could just say like ane, e, and it just means me.
Along with experimenting with language, Bahjat is interested in playing around with pop culture references, like Aladdin. Most of us know that story from Disney, about the overly ambitious burglar. But Bahjat puts a spin on that character. Habibie, you're so unattainable. It's
like you are made of gold, and it makes me want you more. I was like, yeah, like, I want to be the Aladdin of the music industry, but I want to show you that, you know, sometimes being an Aladdin means that you have no choice but to be overly ambitious and overly, you know, really eager to achieve what you want to achieve, because naturally life doesn't give you that. You don't have a decision on where you're born and the opportunities that brings you.
Despite his growing popularity, it's not easy to make it as an independent artist. And Bahjat says not everyone is supportive of his music.
Sadly, a lot of it comes from my home country because of the way I sing, and my type of lyrics are very conversational. And I guess people are not used to hearing the Libyan dialect sung in a modern way, which is like very like straight to the point. I'm not trying to say, you know, very poetic things all the time. And, you know, combined with the way I look, my fashions, you know, choices and all of these things, it kind of makes me an easy target.
But Bahjat says he is willing to take the hit so that the next generation of Libyan artists can be more free to express themselves.
I was talking to my mom and she was like, you know, Bahjat, you should write them a song and mention every name of the Arabic countries just as a thank you, because these are the people who have got your back. So I hung up from the call from my mom. I grabbed my guitar and I started singing like, Min Libya al Tunis Maghrib li. So kind of going through the countries. Min Libya al Tunis Maghrib li Mas
lil Jazair min Syria al Urdan. I asked Bahjat what's next for him. He tells me he wants to keep growing as a musician, release his first full album, and help take A-pop global. For the world, I'm Halima Gikhandi.
Halima's story first aired on the show last winter. Since then, Bahjat Atorjman put out a new tune called For a Child. A little kid should be on a playground, not hiding underground, asking, will mom come back around? Bahjat says he wrote the song after waking up at night thinking about what Palestinian kids in Gaza are going through right now. You can find that track on Spotify and YouTube. World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at UBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other out there.